thousands or tens of thousands every year that they spent on things like visiting musicians and speakers and putting on events and putting in stuff like that, renting a bus to go somewhere, stuff like that. And so this was the bread and butter for musicians like Robert. And then later for many years for me, these kinds of college gigs, all of which basically dried up by the early 2000s for some reason.
Yeah, well, you give a litany, at least, well, of a very few of some of those people. You cite Daryl Cherney, Judy Barry, Danny Dollinger, Dana Lyons, Casey Neal, Peg Millett. I'm sorry to say, other than Judy Barry, who, of course, was more famous for being blown up by the FBI, I don't recognize any of these names. You've done a whole project at your website, davidrovics.com, where you're on activist music, which is something that, you know, as a music producer or as a program a content creator myself, but I've often looked for, you know, musical numbers to break up segment shows, and I've always been frustrated by the lack of political isn't really the right term, but of a protest music or of culturally active music in that regard. It's always been hard to find, and you've made a big effort to make that that those kinds of artists and their music available through your site.
Yeah, I really want everybody out there to know that this is a long-standing global tradition, and it also part of the confusion with some of these kinds of things is there's also a tendency, you know, that goes way back in the music industry to turn individual musicians or songwriters into some kind of a, you know, mythic, legendary kind of like genius kind of, you know, that's how they all get pitched. And so if you were to pitch somebody by saying, well, this person's really good, but they're just part of a broader tradition, well, that's not, you know, how you want to pitch people generally. But it's the reality is that when you're talking about people who are writing songs about what goes on in the world, what, you know, which we call, you know, whether we talk political music or topical or protest or whatever, you know, terms we try to use to, you know, encapsulate what it is that this music is doing. It's basically, it's hard to describe because because of the music industry. You know, it's not your fault. You can't come up with a good name for it. You know, it goes way back because the music industry, like way back 100 years ago, told us that if you're writing anything about anything other than songs about relationships, love lost, love found, you know, staying up all night and having a party, you know, if you're writing about something other than those acceptable subjects, then it is basically novelty music, or it's political, or it's something, you know, that should be pushed off to the margins. But historically, this kind of music is the norm, actually. It was the music industry that tried to flip things around and say that love songs are the norm and everything else is weird. You know, that was, you know, love songs have always been the norm too, but so have songs about, you know, wars and police brutality and mine disasters and corrupt politicians. Ever since we've been writing songs in English, there have been songs about all of those things that I just listed, you know. And in the current era, or particularly in the 90s, in the era that I was describing in my article about traveling with Robert, musicians like Dana Lyons and Casey Neal and Daryl Cherney and Judy Barry, Peg Millett, I mean, in the Earth First scene, those were and are in many cases still the musicians who were keeping that kind of tradition alive.
Well, and you mentioned too a couple others that I do know, actually, Ann Feeney and Chris Chandler, and they're friends of yours as well. And Ann Feeney, of course, she passed away a few years ago now, but they're, you know, hugely. What's the term? What term were you like singers of relevant songs? I guess as you put it yourself.
Yeah, I like the term that I first learned from a wonderful two-woman duo in Seattle named Rebel Voices, Janet Secker and Susan Lewis. They had an album a long time ago, I guess in the 80s, called Songs of Social Significance, which was named after a song by the same name from a Broadway musical in the 1930s. And I just thought that was had a nice ring to it, Songs of Social Significance. So that's what I have on my website as well, but it's songs that are about life on Earth. So it's hard to pin that down with a label because it's too broad, you know. But the media in the 60s started calling it protest music. That's what they called it, embraced that term, because it's you know, just like people embrace the term hippie, you know. I mean, nobody called themselves hippies in the 60s. You know, that was the media calling people hippies. But eventually, you know, people, the term stuck, because when you'd say a term like freak, you know, or radical or whatever, people would wonder, well, what are you talking about? Who's that? You know, but we've heard the term hippie, you know, and same with protest music. If you say I'm a topical musician, which is what like somebody like Phil Oakes like to call himself, a topical musician, problem with that is nobody knows what you're talking about.
How do you do? I'm David, a singer of songs of social significance. And you?
Yeah. Right. I mean, you can put that on your website, but when you're going to introduce yourself, like, you can say, I'm a singer-songwriter with a political bent or something, you know, something that's a little like, easy to understand.
Well, bent, you can get into deep water with that term right away. But when you talk about, you know, being the singers being sold and sold singularly as a superstar or something extraordinary, and which, you know, many of these people are extraordinarily talented and everything else, it reminds of the lyric, the Pink Floyd lyric, you know, which one's pink? And it's funny to me that it seems that the propaganda machine, in the geopolitical sense, at least the United States and its acolytes, are using that same thing. Which one is pink? Well, pink is Putin. You know, they always pick out a singular character to heap upon that individual all of the evil attributes that Satan enjoys as well. You know, that it makes things so much simpler to sell.
Yeah, the simple sell. I mean, the media is more propagandistic than it has ever been in my entire life, which is really saying something. I lived through 2003, 2001. I can't imagine the media being more propagandistic and nationalistic and Islamophobic and everything else than it was then. But now, we see what is possible. And it's now not just the U.S. media, but the entire Western press. And I used to listen to, I still do listen to the German and the French and the other English language broadcasts from different broadcasters in other countries, because it used to be, actually, there was a discernibly different, even if it's another, you know, European wealthy country, you know, there were significant political differences and differences in how they covered things that could be found quickly by, you know, watching Franz von Katscher or listening to Radio Deutsche Welle or something like that. But that all changed with the past year, and I know there are certainly political differences between the leaders of countries like the U.S. and many European countries, which behind the scenes may have very different attitudes about what they would have liked to do about, you know, whatever issues they had with the Russian government, which, of course, is always summed up as being all about one guy, which is also ridiculous. You know, in terms of the foreground, what they put out in the press, it's been just a remarkable lockstep. One of Biden's favorite terms, which is funny that he likes it so much, but they're just in lockstep, absolutely.
Well, because it sounds
vilifying Putin and making it, you know, making it all out to be this dried situation of the favorite word, of course, unprovoked invasion, which was a very interesting and I think intentional way to confuse the words unjustified and unprovoked, because justifying something is a matter of opinion and it's a matter of strategy, you know, but provocation, I mean, that's very simple. And it's a pretty low bar to explain what's provoked and what's not provoked. And they're just lying every time they say unprovoked, because it's obviously there's so many provocations that how can you even say unprovoked with a, you know, serious face? I mean, list the possible provocation, but what they're doing is intentionally confusing the concept of provocation with justification, which is a moral concept. Justification is a moral concept. Provocation is an observable thing. Like you expand NATO against your, you promise not to expand NATO and then you do, you promise not to send missiles into a country, then you do, you know, that's called provocation. That's a basic definition of provocation. If those aren't provocative actions, then there is no such thing as provocative. Then you should just stop using the word provocation, because it has no place in the English language, unless you're going to actually define it. Like, you punch me, I punch you back. You know, you punch me, that's a provocation. I punch you back, that's a response. You know, That's very clear. You know, you put missiles in the neighboring country, you invite them to join a military alliance that was formed to keep you in contained by its very definition, by its own self-definition. It exists to contain you, and then you put missiles in a neighboring country. You know, that's a provocation, right? Clearly. So that every time the media says the unprovoked invasion, they're lying every time. Every day, every minute.
Well, and the word itself, I mean, the words are important for more than just the meaning they convey, obviously, but for what they come to mean. And provocation is now one of those terms where anyone that utters that, oh, well, there was provocation on the part of the West and NATO, especially as regards the what's going on in Ukraine right now, is the key trigger for people to say, well, you're a Putin defender, then you're trying to justify what Putin did. We've seen the media now is worse than I've ever seen it, and I've been studying it for 30 years myself, or even more actually. I'm sorry to say, but there's a clear progression. And you said, you know, 2001, 2003. Well, 2003 is interesting because that's the anniversary. I'm assuming that you're referring to the anniversary of America's invasion of Iraq, which the anniversary for is just any day now, as we speak, with March 20 or 18 or 20, as I recall, and yet we're seeing these same kinds of people in the American administration standing up, and I got that image of Colin Powell with his little vial at the United Nations, and citing as the provocation for America's invasion of that country and all the disaster that followed that, being the so-called weapons of mass destruction that Iraq possessed and America knew because they had the receipts, is the old joke.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's really remarkable how things can happen almost neatly on the 20th anniversary of other similar events. You know, the lies, the 31 lies that General Powell recited at the United Nations right around this time, 20 years ago, was it? And now it's just a whole litany of made-up history, just total revising of the past 30 years, to say nothing of course, you know, the past century of Western Russian relations and provocations and proxy wars and so-called cold wars and hot wars and millions dead and cities carpet bombed, infrastructure completely destroyed from the air by the U.S. Air Force and country after country after country. And then they just ignore all that and talk about provocations in only one way, not the other. It's just a totally made up history, just as of the same quality as General Powell's 31 lies.
And the results, I mean, these last, we've talked about this before, and I've mentioned, and at the risk of being repetitive, that when I started the show was during the war against the former Yugoslavia, and all of the lies and the media manipulation that was going on then, though it was, I think, nascent. They were new tricks being tried out. But since then, we've seen that the same thing honed and perfected, this media manipulation and this co-opting of media, embedding into the message of this industrial killing project has gotten better and better, but it always repeats. We've seen it time and again now for these last 20 years. It's just been more than 20 years now, but going from one thing to the next.
It's like a script. I mean, it's like you can just write it in advance. You just, much of the time you know what's going to happen next. And what's remarkable is that it keeps on working and that people don't seem to remember when they did this the last time. You know, I mean, in some cases because they're not old enough, but in other cases I don't really understand how they can fall for this again and again.
Well, I wonder if they do. I mean, or maybe we're just told they do. Like, as you mentioned rightly to me, that America isn't divided, the American polity isn't divided the way it's projected to be on the media. People have a lot more in common than they do have differences. And I wonder in this case if we're just told that we believe something because it's convenient for us to believe it. But do people still believe this?
I think you're right. For to a large extent, that's true, and so much of this what appears to be consent is manufactured. Absolutely, but there are definitely people who drink Kool-Aid, and of course, it's impossible to separate online from offline, you know. But I feel like it's much more real when I actually meet people in person, in the real physical world. Who have these kinds of views, not just somebody on Twitter who may or may not be a bot or an agent. And of course, you don't know necessarily who the agents are, but at least when you meet somebody at a concert, you know they're not a bot. And there are a lot of real people, including highly intelligent people, who have come to the conclusion that sending massive amounts of military aid to Ukraine is a good idea. And I understand that it's a very complicated thing, and I have deep concern and sympathy for all those Ukrainians who have been killed and all of the Ukrainian refugees and all of those cities destroyed. Absolutely, just as I had sympathy and empathy for all of the Iraqis who were refugees because of the same kinds of circumstances. But, you know, this doesn't mean that I think that the solution to the problem here is sending billions of dollars worth of missiles to the Ukrainians who are fighting the Russian invaders. There's a lot of other possible paths to take aside from brinksmanship and bringing us closer to Armageddon than we've been in the history of the planet. There are alternatives to that, and they need to be pursued, like right now, and yesterday, and 30 years ago. But you know, they should have been pursued a hell of a long time ago, but they weren't. And, it may or may not be too late to pursue them now, but as long as we're still breathing, then it's not too late to pursue alternatives to annihilation.
Yeah, and those alternative paths will be pursued in the future if, barring Armageddon, because that's the way all wars end. People end up sitting down and talking. I would hate to conflate your comment about intelligent people believing that sending these arms and everything else is the right thing to do with the people in my country at the helm of the political process, Prime Minister Trudeau being foremost among them. But he too has gone along with this idea that Canada sending billions and billions of dollars and loads of armaments and soldiers and so-called trainers and everything else, that's happening in this country too. So for those in the United States who still harbor this idea that Canada is different than America, or that the name Trudeau means what it meant when our current prime minister's father was the leader of this country, I'll just read you a little bit from what comes from Trudeau's office yesterday. It says, 1 year ago, Putin launched a brutal full-scale invasion of Ukraine in the face of the immense human suffering, appalling human rights violations, and cruelty inflicted upon the people of an independent sovereign nation. Ukraine still stands strong. And then he goes on to say that Canada will back them, as the header of this press release from the Prime Minister's office says, right to the bitter end, that Canada will continue down this war path, he's saying, providing billions of Canadian taxpayer dollars and all the armaments we can round up and send along, and whatever covert support as well, until the final objective is reached, although the final objective isn't quite spelled out. But it seems obvious that that final objective is the destruction of at least Vladimir Putin, if not Russia entirely.
Very unclear. They never like to talk about the final objective because the possibilities are too horrifying to consider, because obviously one of them is the annihilation of life on Earth, and then, I don't know what the other possibilities are, but that's definitely the one that concerns me the most. And it's also a very likely outcome here. And it's not the way to go, but definitely it's not just the politicians who believe that sending all these arms are a good idea. There are a lot of people who support this, and as you know, it's not just mythology that people go and join the Ukrainian army. I don't know how many people are doing it these days, but at the beginning there were quite a few from other parts of the world. And also, like, most anarchists in Ukraine at this point, from what I've heard from European anarchists in other parts of Europe, they have joined the Ukrainian military. You know, there's a lot of people who think this is the way to go, and they have their reasons. And especially for those who are Ukrainians, they're very sensible reasons. I completely empathize, you know, but on the broader geopolitical level here, in terms of thinking about our species and life on Earth generally, deconfliction is the only sensible path when it comes to conflicts between the U.S. and Russia. To say, you know, forgetting about any of the actual other good reasons for deconfliction or for just not having this, you know, rivalry in the first place, you know, because it's a totally manufactured rivalry in the first place. There is no Russian empire at all. By the same token, there's no Chinese empire either. All this you know, there's no reason there needs to be this rivalry between these countries. It's being manufactured in Washington, D.C. China and Russia are not trying to take over the world. They're just in the world. Those countries are in the world, and the U.S. is constantly making life and politics and economics difficult for those countries in all kinds of intentional ways. And there's other ways that these conflicts can be resolved if they need to exist in the first place. You know, I'm personally all for, you know, taxing Chinese imports if you're doing that because of China not paying their workers enough, you know. But of course, that's not why it's happening. You know, that would be a good kind of move if we could have tariffs that were related to how badly countries pay their workers. That would be a good incentive to increase wages. And that kind of thing, I would think would be a sensible move. But these threats of war and sending arms to Taiwan and to Ukraine and constantly talking about intentions to invade, which didn't exist but are being provoked, you know, through these kinds of policies of these brinkmanship policies of the Biden administration and others, notably to some extent, not necessarily including the Trump administration. But it's not the way to go.
Well, globalization of the right things, as a talk by David Suzuki, I recall, it resounds like what you're saying. We don't mind globalization if it's globalization of environmental standards. It's if it's globalization of union or worker protection,
labor
worker standards. Rights, or these sort of things. Safety. Yeah, by all means, globalize it. But what we've seen is the strip mollification of media that across at least what used to be called the Western civilization, that there's nowhere really to run other than into the arms of the enemy. I mean, to just briefly get back to Robert Hoyt, before we talk about your upcoming album, Killing the Messenger, which I promoted in the intro, we haven't said one word about yet, but Robert Hoyt's one of his albums is American Is You, and it reminds me of this idea that, if you don't love it, then leave it. You know, if you don't love America, leave it. If you're critical, you know, love it or leave it was the old saying, usually a right-wing saying, but, you know, get out of here if you don't like it. Well, getting out of here, there's nowhere to go. You're not going to get out of America and come to Canada and expect anything different, or go to Germany or anywhere in Western Europe, because they're all singing from the same songbook now. So that's the segue, because we're fast running out of time, David. The Killing the Messenger is your album. It's coming up now. Tell me a little bit about the album, what's on there, and who's killing whom.
Well, definitely the killing the messenger concept could be related to all sorts of different people, but in this case it is definitely related to Julian Assange. There's three songs on the album that are about his persecution, his ongoing persecution, and the efforts of the U.S. government to extradite him and put him in prison for 175 years for exposing U.S. war crimes. And other songs on the album are about other equally controversial subjects. And it was all recorded, or sort of partly it's that recording continues. But as far as my part in it and other musicians involved, we were in Hawaii for the last half of January working on the album, and should be out sometime in the next few weeks.
April 11th is the anniversary, the fourth anniversary of Assange being illegally extracted, at least against international law, from his asylum in a foreign nation's embassy, Ecuador in this case, who signed off on him being taken out, although that doesn't make it legal that that happened. 4 years he's been in process, in prison, in a max prison in London. And just wasting away. I mean, that adds to all the time he spent in asylum before that, and various other things. It's beyond, and it means so much for not only, of course, for him, but for journalism and for all of us that rights can be so easily swept away.
If they can do this to him, they can do it to any of his any of the. Journalistic outfits, outlets that collaborated with WikiLeaks on exposing all of those things that he exposed with the war crimes and the embassy cables and everything. You know, as you know, potentially anybody, any editor or journalist at the New York Times or, you know, The Guardian or El País or whatever, they could all go to prison.
Yeah, but I don't expect that that's going to be something that's going to happen anytime soon. You're going on tour soon, though. You're going to be off to autumn in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it'll be their autumn. I'll be it's next month for us. It's spring. Yeah, I'll be March 20th to April 12th in Australia, and later in April I'll be on the East Coast around D.C., Virginia, I think, and then in late May and June I'll be in Denmark and Britain and Ireland.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Yeah, following the sun, you get the nice weather. I see that you like the weather, right? You're going to follow this from Hawaii to Australia, then up to – good idea.
Well, no, it's completely coincidental. I really prefer winter. And when I was in Australia, one of my musical collaborators, Lorna McKinnon from Glasgow, she was really looking forward to going to Hawaii and recording, because you know everybody wants to go to Hawaii because you've heard all these things about it. And you know, basically, as soon as we got there, it took about 10 minutes before she was like, "It's too hot." And you know, I knew it would be too hot, and I completely agreed with her already. You know, but it, she had to experience it herself to realize that it's too hot. And then you know, we got into the coffee farm in the woods where we were making the album, and she immediately started getting eaten by mosquitoes. And then
it's too mosquito-y.
Oh yeah. And then basically by the time we came home or get back to Portland, we were both truly looking forward to the freezing rain that we knew was going to be greeting us when we got off the plane. And we truly enjoyed the freezing rain, and we were both still happy to be back when we got back. So no, I've actually toured. I used to do it a long time ago, where I would go to Australia in their winter and do a tour there, so I could skip summer in Portland and have two winters, one here and one in Australia. I did that several years, but it's not always, hasn't always been easy to engineer it that way since I started having kids and stuff. So I'm ending up home for the hot summer against my will in order to spend time with the children. But no, I really prefer where it's always below 70 Fahrenheit for sure. Should never be above that.
Well, that's hardly winter. But, well, all right, the contrary David Rovics you can find at davidrovics.com and his many works. As usual, David, I can't even scratch on all the stuff that you're up to. But what I'm really going to do, I'm going to follow up on Robert Hoyt and the Travels with Claude documentary about he and his cat Claude, which is on YouTube, as your article mentions. And that article, again, is up at counterpunch.org, remembering Robert Hoyt. It's at David's other platforms as well, but that's where I saw this one. Thanks a lot, David, for coming on again and for all the work that you do. And good luck on the next leg of your continuing world adventure.
Thank you very much, Chris. Great talking to you.
All right, then. People sick.
Time bomb tick in the town of East Palestine. Acrid air across the county. Who knows whether to stay or flee? The EPA says it's all clean. It says so on this machine in the town. Palestine. The next coming soon, as surely as the rising moon. The air, the water, and lives at stake, but we can't make them get new breaks. Just ask the folks in East Palestine. Just ask.